somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 21, The Bulwark of Liberty, Free Speech in 18th Century America, Part 1.
Our current libel laws are a sham and a disgrace and do not represent American values or American fairness, so we're going to take a strong look at that.
The clip you just heard was from January 2018 and features U.S. President Trump. It's just one of many times where Trump has proposed changing libel laws, revoking broadcasting licenses, or questioned the legality of news stories, satire, or books critical of his person or policies. In most countries, such statements by the head of state would cause dread among journalists, writers, and comedians, for fear that words might be followed by action and a genuine crackdown on press freedom. That has been the standard operating procedure in places like Venezuela, Turkey, Russia, and even Hungary. To be sure, Trump's comments are roundly condemned. But there doesn't seem to be any real panic about the future of press freedom among American media outlets who depend on this precious liberty for their work. The critical stories come thick and fast, quite literally on a daily basis. A 2017 Pew Research study of President Trump's first 100 days in office showed that negative news stories about Trump outweighed positive ones by a factor of 4. And according to the Conservative Media Research Center, 92% of media coverage by ABC, NBC, and CBS was negative during 4 months of 2018, though the picture would probably have differed if the study had included Fox News. The recent journalists and writers sleep calmly at night, even after being declared enemies of the people on Twitter by @RealDonaldTrump. Is that freedom of speech and the press rests on firm legal ground in the U.S. In his recent book, The Free Speech Century, Columbia University president and First Amendment scholar Lee Bollinger calls America the most speech-protective of any nation on earth, now or throughout history. One of the landmark decisions that cemented this speech-protective environment was New York Times v. Solomon, decided on 9th March 1964, where the Supreme Court declared that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open, and must be allowed to include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials. So the risk of the Saturday Night Live cast being perp-walked out of the Comcast building or CNN being pulled off the air is pretty remote. No matter how unflatteringly Alec Baldwin portrays Donald Trump, or how aggressive Jim Acosta questions the president. But throughout American colonial history, the kind of criticism that American presidents and politicians have to stomach constituted a crime, a seditious libel. As we saw in episode 18, the punishments for seditious libel were often brutal in the 17th century and included cropping of ears, whippings, and imprisonment. Needless to say, press censorship was also strict, and several colonies simply banned print technology. But in the 18th century, attitudes changed as colonists started asserting the freedom to criticize local government and policies as part of the growing demand for popular sovereignty, which took place within a positive feedback loop of collapsing press controls that created a public sphere with discussion of politics. The clash over press freedom would explode as the relationship between England and her unruly American colonists worsened from the 1760s and ended in a nasty, violent breakup in the following decade. So as we shall see, the freedom to criticize, skewer, and mock the commander-in-chief that most Americans take for granted today is anything but a given. It took fearless journalists, bold free thinkers, clever lawyers, eloquent pamphleteers, and calculated opportunism to change popular opinion in favor of expanding the limits of American freedom of speech. Many of those who are celebrated as the founders of American freedom and independence played a pivotal role in erecting the bulwark of liberty that freed the pens and tongues of Americans. But for long, there was no consensus on just how free the press should be. And when the crisis with Britain erupted, many good patriots were prepared to sacrifice principle when loyalists or those not sufficiently committed to the cause sought shelter behind the bulwark of liberty. But in order to fully appreciate the events that unfolded in 18th century America, we have to spend some time on political, legal, and philosophical developments in the late 17th and early 18th century England, which directly and indirectly influenced the idea and practice of press freedom in the American colonies. Last episode, we left Britain after William of Orange sent James II packing and conquered the throne in the Glorious Revolution, which was not all that glorious if you were a Catholic or anti-Trinitarian. Or if you wanted more republic and less monarchy, more freedom of thought and conscience, and less Protestant intolerance. Most Whigs saw the Glorious Revolution as the end of history. England now had a perfectly mixed constitution with ordered liberty and the right measure of religious tolerance. Their political opponents, the more conservative Tories, were more torn about the merits of the Glorious Revolution and especially its guarantee of wider religious toleration. But there was also a more radical wing who, in the midst of English triumphalism, saw danger signs of corruption and ministerial overreach, and who didn't think the Bill of Rights and Toleration Act went far enough. The radical Whigs, who called themselves the real or independent Whigs, were influenced by old friends of the podcast like Milton, Locke, and Algernon Sidney. Their core belief was that power corrupts unless diffused by separation of powers and governments were kept on a tight leash to protect the liberty of the individual. They were also staunch defenders of freedom of conscience, even for Jews, Unitarians, Muslims, and ultimately for Catholics. They were in favor of freedom of the press and a more inclusive franchise. As we'll see, these radicals, whose ideas would not be implemented in England until the 19th century, became hugely influential in 18th century colonial America. To a large extent, their ideas became the ideological origins of the American Revolution, to use the title of historian Bernard Bailyn's classic work. Although radical Whigs were unimpressed, the combination of the Toleration Act and the expiry of the Licensing Act resulted in a dramatic increase in publications, newspapers, and more daring ideas in the realms of politics and religion. I provided some data on this in the last episode. Algernon Sidney had been executed for treason under Charles II in 1683. The unpublished manuscript of his treatise, Discourses Concerning Government, which argued for republican government, was used against him during his trial. But in 1698, Discourses could be published with no problem. Another development also greatly expanded the practical sharing of ideas, news, and even science. In 1651, the Angel in Oxford opened its doors and let customers sip the new liquid black magic from Arabia, coffee. In the words of author Tom Standage, coffee houses swiftly became the preferred drink of scientists, intellectuals, merchants, and clerks, and coffee houses established themselves as centers of information exchange where the latest pamphlets, broadsheets, gazettes, and newsletters could be read and discussed. At the turn of the 17th century, London alone boasted of 550 coffee houses, up from 83 in 1663. Many coffee houses catered to specific clienteles, whether scientists, politicians, writers, poets, or businessmen who gathered to share, comment, and like news and ideas. To stimulate discussion, coffeehouses would provide newspapers, pamphlets, and other writings. Think of it as a physical Twitter thread or Facebook group. These places also became home to coffeehouse radicals of the radical Whig sort who wanted further Republican reforms and whose ideas would travel west. Unlike posh London clubs reserved for the upper classes, coffeehouses were egalitarian in nature. What matters was what you brought to the coffee table in terms of intellectual input, not the size of your wallet or purity of your bloodline. As we've seen time and again in this series, there are few things which absolutist rulers fear more than the free flow of ideas and information among the riffraff. To power and privilege, that cocktail has always been a recipe for sedition and revolution. And true enough, in 1675, King Charles II issued a royal proclamation aimed at closing down coffee houses, which caused very evil and dangerous effects, for that in such houses, diverse, false, malicious and scandalous reports are devised and spread abroad to the defamation of His Majesty's government and to the disturbance and quiet of the realm. But the craving for caffeine and the debate it fueled was too strong among his subjects, so Charles had to back down. Held by the expiry of the Licensing Act and the explosion of print materials, coffee houses became known as penny universities, because they allowed anyone to enter an informal institution of knowledge and ideas for a penny, the price for a cup of coffee. The editor of The Spectator, Joseph Addison, put it eloquently.
It was said of Socrates that he brought philosophy down from heaven to inhabit among men, and I shall be ambitious to have it said of me that I have brought philosophy out of closets and libraries, schools and colleges, to dwell in clubs and assemblies, at tea tables and in coffee houses.
And these penny universities produce groundbreaking ideas. According to Tom Standage, Newton's most celebrated work, Principia, with Newton's law of universal gravitation, was inspired by a previous discussion among fellow scientists at a coffee house. And the Scottish Enlightenment thinker and economist Adam Smith wrote much of his most famous work, The Wealth of Nations, at the British Coffee House, where he hung out while living in London. As we'll see, coffee houses and taverns would also become dens of dissent and play a key role in maturing and spreading the ideas that led to the American Revolution. Despite the intellectual safe space of coffee houses, English law was hardly libertarian. Seditious libel was still a crime. In 1704, Chief Justice John Holt explained the deeply conservative, elitist, and deferential rationale for seditious libel.
If people should not be called to account for possessing the people with an ill opinion of the government, no government can subsist. For it is very necessary for all governments that the people should have a good opinion of it. And nothing can be worse to any government than to endeavor to procure animosities as to the management of it. This has always been looked upon as a crime, and no government can be safe without it.
Many dozens were convicted, but hundreds were intimidated through so-called informations, a method that allowed the authorities to bypass grand juries and arrest provocative pens, bring them before court, and then often dismiss the charges. But even if they walked free, the unlucky writers had to foot the cost for this sham legal procedure. An effective warning which let the author know that the authorities were watching and were none too pleased with what they read. Until the 1760s, general warrants also allowed extremely intrusive search and seizure of anyone suspected of being involved in writing or disseminating seditious libels. It was also settled law that at trial, jurors only had a simple job. They had to determine whether the defendant had indeed written or published whatever work had offended the high and mighty, and whether the work was aimed at whoever the defendant was charged with libeling. but it was for the judge to determine whether the content constituted seditious libel. Oh, and truth was no defense, but might actually be an aggravating factor. As if being hauled before a common law court for seditious libel without having any real defense was not sufficiently detrimental to free speech and due process, the concept of parliamentary privilege threw all semblance of these principles out the window. According to the Coronation Oath and the Bill of Rights, Parliament was sovereign. Its role was both to represent and defend the people against executive and royal overreach. But it needed no advice from those it represented. Freedom of speech was granted to Parliament, not to the people. If non-MPs couldn't hold their tongues and criticize Parliament, either House was entitled to prosecute ordinary people who suffered from the delusion that they were entitled to reflect on how their representatives actually represented them. Which means that Parliament got to act as prosecutor, judge, and jury in cases where the offended party was Parliament itself. And we're not just talking about verbal condemnations. Parliament could imprison and fine offenders who had held its authority and reputation in contempt. Sometimes parliamentary privilege was even abused to punish people who had been acquitted for seditious libel by juries. Try to get your head around that. This Kafkaesque system was enthusiastically embraced by colonial assemblies in America. It was not only prominent judges who supported the suppression of ideas that tended to undermine authority and government. Daniel Defoe is most famous for writing Robinson Crusoe. But he also received a number of convictions for seditious libel that included being pilloried and imprisoned in 1703. Still, Defoe insisted that governments should not be at the mercy of every pen. And an anonymous Tory writer warned that seditious libelers were the very assassins of all government, who had to be stopped since a civil war began with ink may end in blood. Such views were mainstream in early 18th century, where memories of the bloody civil war in the 1640s were still present, and deference to properly constituted authority was seen as the precondition for liberty. But there were also those who saw deference to liberty as the precondition for properly constituted authority. We've already seen that in the 1640s, levelers like William Walden and John Lilburn offered a radical defense of free speech that went much further than the more famous but comparatively moderate John Milton. It bears repeating the following quote from a 1649 petition shortly before the levelers were crushed by Cromwell.
To refer all books and pamphlets to the judgment, discretion, or affection of licensors, or to put the least restraint upon the press, seems altogether inconsistent with the good of the Commonwealth and expressly opposite and dangerous to the liberties of the people.
The reason I highlight this quote is because it expands press freedom from being solely an instrument of establishing the truth, the standard fair defense, by which authors at the time typically meant the triumph of Protestantism over Catholicism and other heresies. To the levelers, press freedom was not only necessary to discover truth. It was a first principle on which the liberty of the people and the legitimacy of government depended. The truth argument would continue to play a significant role, also in more secularized versions. But the idea of freedom of speech, as necessary for liberty, would become absolutely essential to the spread and success of free speech advocacy in 18th century America. In the early 18th century, a number of English authors refined and expanded the level of defense of freedom of speech. One of them was Matthew Tindal, a free thinker, rationalist, and self-styled Christian deist whose enemies accused him of being a Spinozist. And you can see why. In 1698, Tindal published The Liberty of the Press. He insisted that men have the same right to communicate their thoughts as to think themselves. This sounds strikingly like Spinoza, though Tindal's work was aimed at religious writings, whereas Spinoza merely saw religious writings as part of the broader freedom of speech. But in 1704, Tindal follows suit in his Reasons Against Restraining the Press, which made the case for freedom of both religious and political speech. Tyndall may not directly have attacked seditious libel, but he may as well. Tyndall claimed that everyone has a natural right in all matters of learning and knowledge, and neither discussion of religion or government were to be exempted. This was so.
The chief happiness, as well as dignity of rational creatures, consists in having the liberty of thinking on what subject they please, and of us freely communicating their thoughts.
Tyndall also held that no ministry can be hurt by the liberty of the press. In fact, the liberty of the press must keep a ministry within some tolerable bounds by exposing their ill designs to the people. Tyndall even undermined parliamentary privilege by asking the rather pertinent question of why Parliament, which enjoyed freedom of the press, should deny those they represent this liberty. This quote sums up Tyndall's views nicely.
In a word, there's no freedom, either civil or ecclesiastical, but there the liberty of the press is maintained. So wherever that is secured, all others are safe. That, like a faithful sentinel, prevents all surprise and gives timely warning of any approaching danger.
Even if Tyndall also used anti-Catholic boilerplate and Protestant triumphalism, reasons against restraining the press did much to secularize the defense of press freedom and establish this freedom on the pillars of rationality, liberty, and natural rights. But he also cut through the barbed wire of seditious libel, which ring-fenced critical political speech. Tyndall was read in the American colonies, but his influence on American free speech pales entirely compared to the writings of Cato. Wait a minute, I hear you say. Didn't Cato commit suicide in 46 BC back in episode 2? True, but in 1720, Cato was revived by the radical Whigs John Trenchard and Thomas Gordon, who authored the Cato's Letters, first published in the London Journal and then as a separate volume. Cato's letters stressed individual and political freedom and warned against the despotic tendencies of arbitrary government. And for Cato, the very precondition for liberty was freedom of speech. And that was also the topic of Cato's letter number 15, which included this opening salvo.
Without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom and no such thing as public liberty without freedom of speech.
Pretty bold claims. But Cato would also go on to explain why. Tyndall had portrayed freedom of speech as a sentinel. Cato would use a similar image to create a powerful free speech meme that went viral in the colonies.
Freedom of speech is the great bulwark of liberty. They prosper and die together, and it is the terror of traitors and oppressors and a barrier against them.
Freedom of speech as the bulwark of liberty would be repeated endlessly in colonial writings, and also find its way into Virginia's constitution in 1776 and Madison's initial draft of what would become the First Amendment. It chimed perfectly with growing sentiments of popular sovereignty where colonists saw themselves as citizens and not mere subjects. Cato further fanned the flames of this idea by cleverly conceding that government officials should be treated respectfully, but only when they deserved so. Secret mischief was the prerogative of tyranny, and free speech was the people's way of exposing the road to serfdom. For Cato, the administration of government is nothing else but the attendance of the trustees of the people upon the interest and affairs of the people. So to stay on the straight and narrow path, it was in the interest of officials to have their deeds openly examined and publicly scanned. Only tyrants feared the people's judgment. Trenchard and Gordon did not just use ideological and utilitarian arguments. They also sought to demonstrate the intimate link between freedom of speech and liberty through historical precedents. Charles I's heavy-handed censorship of religious and political dissent in the previous century was clear evidence of how despotism and censorship went hand in hand. But Trenchard and Gordon drew their chief historical lessons from the Roman historian Tacitus and his account of how the fall of the Republic resulted in a crackdown on Roman libertas of the tongue, as we also saw in episode 2. So as noted by scholar Robert Martin, Cato's letters is a secular, rational, and political defense of freedom of speech, which largely ignores scripture or religious arguments. Based on Cato's doctrine of free speech fundamentalism, you might think that it was a principled attempt to abolish the very concept of seditious libel. Because the only limits on free speech acknowledged in Cato's letter number 15 was an injunction not to hurt and control the right of another. But like Spinoza's theological political treatise, that offered very little practical guidance of where to draw the line. Yet Cato didn't dodge the difficult question of how far freedom of speech should be protected. Trenchard and Gordon wrote three letters specifically dealing with the question of libel, numbers 32, 100, and 101. Cato had already acknowledged that government officials should be spoken well of when they acted virtuously. Now he conceded that,
as to libels against government, like all others, they are always base and unlawful, and often mischievous, especially when governments are impudently charged with actions and designs of which they are not guilty.
But then he removed most of the teeth from that principle. Truthful statements were not to be punished, even though the common law did not recognize truth as a defense. But more fundamentally, Cato argued that libels were an unavoidable consequence of press freedom, an evil arising out of a much greater good. And the only way to avoid libels would be to return to the bad old days of licensing and star chamber justice.
I must own that I would rather many libels should escape than the liberty of the press should be infringed.
Liberty and licentiousness went hand in hand, and government officials should grow thick skin. This argument has perhaps never been more relevant than today in the age of moral panics over social media and the rush to impose sweeping content-based restrictions on Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms. Cato also feared the vague and arbitrary nature of the crime of seditious libel. Many writings could be interpreted in several ways, and if government could prosecute any writer for literary crimes real or imagined, even when the wording and intentions were unclear, then no pen would be safe. The bulwark of liberty would rest on clay feet, vulnerable to the scheming designs of ambitious ministers. In Legalese, you might say Cato argued that libel should be narrowly construed and that writings should enjoy a presumption of lawfulness unless manifestly criminal. Cato's shrinking concept of seditious libel is deeply infused by the existential fear and loathing of arbitrary power, which was so essential to Cato's conception of liberty in general. And as we shall see, Cato's letters played a crucial role in the practical abolishment of common law trials for seditious libel in 18th century America, because the letters became an absolute sensation in the colonies. It was impossible to open an American newspaper without being confronted with reprints, quotes, or discussion of Cato's letters. According to Forrest MacDonald, it was the most quoted book in all the Americans' pre-revolutionary writings. With developments in England covered, we can now travel both across the pond and back in time. How did the so-called Glorious Revolution play out in America? James II had a long history with the colonies, having ruled as Lord Proprietor of New York since 1664. When he grabbed the colony from the Dutch, he closed the popular assembly. It turned out he had similar plans for the rest of America when he ascended the throne. With the stroke of a pen, he dissolved the 8 northern colonies of New England, New York, and the Jerseys and merged them into one mega-colony called the Dominion of New England. He dissolved the assemblies, appointed Sir Edmund Andros as Governor General, and instructed him to put the press on a tight leash.
And for as much as great inconvenience may arise by the liberty of printing within our said territory under your government, you are to provide by all necessary orders that no person keep any printing press for printing, nor that any book, pamphlet, or other matters whatsoever be printed without your special leave and license first obtained.
So many colonists were relieved in 1689 when ships from England brought news of James' fall. But Andros saw the writing on the wall, panicked and arrested the messengers for bringing traitorous and treasonable libels and papers of news. But it was already too late, and the Dominion came down like a house of cards. Rebels, many of whom suspected Andras' suppression of news to be part of a popish plot, arrested Andras and 24 of his officials in Boston. Rebels took control of New York in late May. Their leader, Jacob Leisler, was a militant Calvinist, and one of his first moves was to arrest and imprison more than 40 of his critics for sedition and treason. He lasted less than 2 years before the home government elected a new governor who ousted Leisler and executed him for treason. William III issued a new colonial charter for Massachusetts, which, to the horror of the most conservative Puritans, declared toleration for all Protestants. The charter also opened voting for all property holders and not just full members of the Puritan churches. Rhode Island got to keep its old colonial charter and remain Rogue Island. Historian Leonard Levy should be a familiar name to loyal listeners by now. In his famous work, Emergence of a Free Press, Levy gave a harsh assessment of the climate for free speech in the colonies.
The persistent image of colonial America as a society in which freedom of expression was cherished is an hallucination of sentiment that ignores history.
Subsequent historians have challenged Levy's verdict as too pessimistic and flying in the face of crucial developments that severely pushed the boundaries of free speech. No matter where your sympathies lie, it is indisputable that the climate for free speech was much brighter in the 18th century than the previous one. Harsh punishments for seditious speech, like the infamous ear croppings, were replaced with milder punishments. By the 1690s, a full 32% of all the punishment for seditious speech in New England were reduced or dropped. 60 years earlier, it was only 8.5%. When it comes to religion, blasphemy cases almost disappeared, and of heresy cases, there were none. Still, just as in England, seditious libel was part and parcel of the common law, and colonists could and were occasionally prosecuted in court in the early part of the 18th century. But that would change dramatically, not least due to Cato's letters and their influence on the ordinary people who made up juries and grand juries. American colonial assemblies were much more difficult to rein in when they felt slighted. And it didn't take much to offend the people's representatives. The use of legislative privilege did not rely on obstinate and fickle grand juries to charge and juries to convict. And since assemblies represented the people, they enjoyed legitimacy, which the often incredibly tenured and buffoonish British governors and their officials did not. According to historian Mary Patterson Clark,
literally scores of persons, probably hundreds throughout the colonies, were tracked down by the various messengers and sergeants and brought into the house to make inglorious submission for words spoken in the heat of anger or for writings which intentionally or otherwise had given offence.
Nonetheless, the milder climate and a greater number of ships carrying news from the motherland provided the perfect conditions for new media to take America by storm in the 18th century. Enter the newspaper and the pamphlet. America's first multi-page newspaper was published in Boston in September 1690. Public Occurrences, as it was called, was determined to combat that spirit of lying which prevails amongst us. It brought an update on the war with the French and slammed the Indian allies fighting on the British side as miserable savages. That was too much for the council and governor, who swiftly issued a public order which found that Public Occurrences
contained reflections of a very high nature, as also sundry doubtful and uncertain reports, do hereby manifest and declare their high resentment and disallowance of said pamphlet, and order that the same be suppressed and called in, strictly forbidding any person or persons for the future to set forth anything in print without license.
All unsold copies of the paper were destroyed. The short-lived Public Occurrences was the only American newspaper published in the 17th century. And in 1690, a colonist from Virginia complained,
"We are here at the end of the world, and Europe may be turned topsy-turvy ere we can hear a word of it."
14 years later, America got its first enduring newspaper, the Boston Newsletter. It inspired a local rival, the Boston Gazette, which we'll hear much more about in part two. By 1739, 13 newspapers operated in 7 different colonies. By 1775, at the dawn of independence, there were 38 newspapers in the mainland colonies. Despite the death of the Licensing Act in 1695, licensing continued in several colonies. In 1719, the Anglican preacher John Shackley was ordered by the Assembly of Massachusetts not to publish a tract that compared deists to dissenters from the Church of England, which of course included Puritans. Only in 1721 did licensing lapse in Massachusetts. But that was not the end of the matter, because in 1721, a new scandalous newspaper launched in Boston. The New England Courant's publisher, James Franklin, invited all men who have leisure, inclination, and ability to speak their minds with freedom. The New England Courant gave voice to contrarian voices, and after an outbreak of smallpox, the Courant became embroiled in a fiery debate between proponents of inoculation and 18th-century anti-vaxxers. On one side was the religious establishment led by the staunchly conservative Puritan theologian Cotton Mather, and on the other side, most of the physicians of Boston, who used the New England Courant to argue their case. Mather reacted furiously to the
notorious scandalous paper, full freighted with nonsense, unmannerliness, raillery, profaneness, immorality, arrogancy, calumnies, lies, contradictions, and whatnot, all tending to quarrels and divisions and to debauch and corrupt the minds and manners of New England.
And this is where your head might explode. Because in the inoculation debate, Mather was right. Those in favor of inoculation were the ministers, while the medical establishment warned that the cure was worse than the disease. So on this issue, Franklin and his New England Courant was the 18th century version of Alex Jones and InfoWars. The New England Courant might have set back science and public health with its tinfoil hat opposition to inoculation. But it also struck a blow for press freedom. As you can probably imagine, the Courant was not licensed. In June 1722, James published a satirical remark on the colonial government's lethargic attempts to battle piracy. This so infuriated the authorities in Massachusetts that James Franklin was imprisoned for a month by the Massachusetts Legislative Assembly, confusingly called the General Court, for violating legislative privilege. Needless to say, no real trial was afforded Franklin, whose guilt was a foregone conclusion. James's 16-year-old younger brother, Benjamin Franklin, was an apprentice at the Courant. But he also contributed to its pages. Hiding behind the pseudonym Silas Duguid, he had a number of essays published in the paper, initially without his older brother knowing that his punk little brother was responsible. While James was imprisoned, young Benjamin Franklin was left in charge. He ingeniously protested his brother's imprisonment by reprinting an article from the London Journal, which included the passage,
"Without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom and no such thing as public liberty without freedom of speech."
Sound familiar? Yup. Franklin Jr. was one of the many Americans hypnotized by the radical defense of freedom of speech in Cato's letter number 15. Ben later told how during his brother's confinement, he had the management of the paper and I made bold to give our rulers some rubs. James apologized and was released, but he got in trouble again next year for a number of pieces that were insufficiently deferential to church and government. The General Court then ordered him not to print anything without their approval. But true to form, James disregarded the order and printed an unlicensed edition of the Courant. But the General Court's order was targeted at James personally. So he exploited this loophole and put Benjamin formally in charge of publishing the paper. Still, James went on the run, but was captured and jailed in late 1723. But a grand jury let him off the hook, probably due to its unwillingness of enforcing the return of licensing. According to scholar Robert Martin, The unsuccessful attempt to have James Franklin indicted by a grand jury not only helped put the final nail in the coffin of pre-publication censorship in the colonies, which finally collapsed in 1730, it was also an early indication of the reluctance of juries and grand juries to act as the colonial authorities' willing censors. Jurors, too, had read Cato's letters and understood that they were undermining their own freedoms by acting too deferentially to hypersensitive local governments. The Koran finally gave up in 1726, but by then Benjamin Franklin had already moved to Philadelphia, where he would open up another independent newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, in which he often championed press freedom. But as we shall see, Franklin also contributed to a less than glorious moment in the history of colonial free speech. The Massachusetts government might have had its censorious nose bloodied by L'Affaire Franklin, but that did not mean that they were about to roll over and let licentiousness pollute the clean and pious air of the Puritan heartland. In 1724, John Checkley, who had been hit with a licensing order in 1719, returned with an almost similar version of the offending work. The Massachusetts Council found the book contained vile and scandalous reflections on both the established church and government in Massachusetts, and Checkley was convicted for seditious libel and forced to pay a fine. 10 years after the Franklin affair, another controversial paper saw the day of light, this time in New York. The New York Weekly Journal was founded in 1733 by a prominent political faction whose members had been purged by the new governor, William Cusby, for failing to toe the line. This included Lewis Morris, the Chief Justice of New York's Supreme Court. Not only was Governor Cusby greedy, petty, corrupt, unprincipled, and vindictive, he also controlled a newspaper, the New York Gazette, which functioned a bit like an 18th-century version of Pravda. I love this quote in Stephen Solomon's brilliant Revolutionary Dissent, which tells you all you need to know about the level of independence of the New York Gazette's editorial line.
Cusby the mild, the happy, good, and great, the strongest god of our little state.
Now that would make even Kim Jong-un queasy. Cusby's enemies decided to give the governor a taste of his own medicine. They set up America's first opposition newspaper. The New York Weekly Journal was published by the German immigrant Peter Senger, though he was just a pawn for the anti-Cusby conspirators. But the real editor was James Alexander, a lawyer and Morris supporter. The journal published a string of hit pieces that savagely attacked and mocked the character and conduct of Governor Cusby. Many of the hardest-hitting pieces were published anonymously or using pseudonyms like Cato. The political hit pieces accused the governor of violating the rules of his office and threatening the liberties and properties of the people. The satire included pretty crude stuff like this.
A monkey of the larger sort has lately broke his chain and run into the country where he has played many a monkey trick. Whosoever shall take this little mischievous animal and send him back to his master so that he may be chained up again shall have for his reward 1,000 thanks.
Cusby wasn't mentioned by name, but everyone knew that he was the ape in question. Cusby was not exactly famous for his sense of humor or thick skin, and the common law crime of seditious libel provided Cusby with the perfect remedy to get the last laugh. So clearly Alexander and the Journal pushed their luck. But the Journal's attack on Cusby was fought on two fronts. The hit pieces were mixed with a heavy dose of Cato's letters on freedom of speech and libel, whose radical message was tailor-made for the anti-Cusby faction. Not only did Cato show that free speech was a natural right, it was the bulwark of liberty and trumped the good name of wicked governors who set aside their role as the people's representatives for personal gain and arbitrary power. Since most New Yorkers thought Cusby a petty tyrant, Alexander bet that popular opinion would be swayed by Cato's principles. So if and when Cusby retaliated, the people would see it as a confirmation that only the wicked governors of men dread what is said of them. And sure enough, Cosby soon ran out of patience with
those insolent and scandalous papers by which these vile wretches would have involved the province in confusion.
But to his frustration, a grand jury refused to indict the anonymous authors of the libelous articles. Instead, 4 editions of the journal were publicly burned. But the reluctant grand jury did not exhaust Cosby's arsenal. One avenue was legislative privilege, but both the provincial and city legislature rejected Cosby's advances, citing the need to preserve liberty of the press. So he turned to the hated instrument of an information to circumvent the grand jury and indict the poor printer Peter Zenger, who was sent to prison on remand, where he spent 8 miserable months in decrepit conditions. But Cosby had more dirty tricks up his sleeve. Presiding over the trial was the very judge Cosby had appointed as new Chief Justice instead of Morris. When challenged, the new Chief Justice removed and disbarred Singer's lawyers, one of whom was James Alexander, the anonymous editor who really should be in the dock, instead of poor Singer. The judge also tried to tamper with the list of potential jurors to ensure the presence of Cosby loyalists. And for good measure, the jurors were threatened with perjury should they acquit. With a biased judge, an intimidated jury, a court-appointed defense attorney, and the law firmly against him, Singer looked doomed. But then, the case took a twist worthy of a Hollywood court drama. On the first day of the trial, Andrew Hamilton rose and announced that he was Singer's new defense counsel. Hamilton was from Philadelphia and a friend of Benjamin Franklin. At 59, Hamilton was the best and one of the most experienced trial lawyers in the colonies, as well as a prominent politician. Think of Hamilton as Rocky or Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven being talked out of retirement for that last good fight. "Old and weak as I am," he told the jurors, "I should think it my duty, if required, to go to the utmost part of the land where my service could be of any use in assisting to quench the flame of prosecutions." Hamilton showed up at a full courtroom in New York City Hall with a controversial high-risk, all-or-nothing strategy. To the gasping courtroom's surprise, he admitted that Singer was guilty of publishing the articles. The attorney general couldn't believe his luck and immediately declared the case over. Since the job of the jury was only to determine if Singer had published the articles, not if the content was seditious libel. Asking the jury to determine the guilt in seditious libel cases was not entirely unprecedented. But Hamilton went even further and appealed to the jury, asking them if the allegations against Cosby weren't notoriously known to be true. He then took a page out of Cato's letters. "The words themselves must be libelous, that is false, scandalous, and seditious, or else we are not guilty," he argued, and disputed that
"the just complaints of a number of men who suffer under a bad administration is libeling that administration."
He cleverly compared the idea that speaking truth to corrupt power was punishable with the notorious Star Chamber trial under Charles I. In other words, Hamilton asked the jury to disregard established common law and declare truth a defense so that freedom of speech might serve its role as the bulwark of liberty. After an hours-long speech that would have winded Fidel Castro, Hamilton's closing statement elevated the case to a principal question of American liberty. Singer's prosecution was
"not the cause of a poor printer, nor of New York alone, which you are now trying. No, it may, in its consequences, affect every freeman that lives under a British government on the main of America. It is a cause of liberty, and I make no doubt but that your upright conduct this day will not only entitle you to the love and esteem of your fellow citizens, but every man who prefers freedom to a life of slavery will bless and honor you as men who have baffled the attempt of tyranny and by an impartial and uncorrupt verdict have laid a noble foundation for securing to ourselves, our prosperity, and our neighbors that to which nature and the laws of our country have given us a right, the liberty both of exposing and opposing arbitrary power by speaking and writing the truth."
The Attorney General and Chief Justice reminded the jury that truth didn't make it any more legal to scandalize the governor and stir public resent with poisonous writings whose bad tendencies threaten public order. But that sounded pretty stale and lame compared to Hamilton's impassioned plea. But Hamilton's strategy paid off. His words found fertile ground among jurors who had no doubt read and discussed the journal's punchy free speech advocacy based on Cato's principles. After receding for a short time, the jury agreed to acquit Sanger, upon which there were three huzzas in the hall, which was crowded with people. Cosby dropped his jaw, and Sanger was free. The case caused a sensation across the colonies. When Hamilton left for Philadelphia, he was greeted with a cannonade, and the New York Common Council hailed his learned and generous defense of the rights of mankind and the liberty of the press. It was a watershed moment for press freedom in America. Not so much because the Sanger case set a legal precedent. It didn't. Formally, the common law crime of seditious libel stood intact and unscathed. But in practice, the acquittal all but ended seditious libel prosecutions in colonial common law courts. Popular opinion had swung so much in favor of an expanded right to freedom of speech as a necessary protection against arbitrary governments and as a right enjoyed by all colonists. Colonial governors could no longer rely on juries to convict publishers of seditious libel. Americans expected to be able to speak truth to power. Now, when I say all colonists and Americans, that chiefly means white males, as slaves were obviously excluded, and few women contributed in the new public sphere. More on how slavery and women's rights became a battleground for free speech in later episodes. Unfortunately for colonial loudmouths, the Sanger case did little to rein in the odious concept of legislative privilege. Well into the late 1750s, the New York Assembly imprisoned printers who had reflected on its honor, justice, and authority by writing far less provocative stuff than what Governor Cosby had had to suffer. In fact, the mere printing of the proceedings and speeches of the assemblies was a breach of privilege. But the Assembly of New York was outdone by the Upper House, or Council, and the Assembly of Pennsylvania. You'll remember from episode 18 that despite Pennsylvania's religious tolerance, political speech was kept on a short leash, and that William Penn himself had signed an order sentencing a political loudmouth to whippings in Philadelphia in the 1680s. And history repeated itself in the 1720s when a man was convicted by a court for seditious libel and sentenced to the pillory and 2 times 41 lashes for offending the king. Around the same time, Andrew Bradford, the son of the first Pennsylvania printer William Bradford, was twice sanctioned by the Pennsylvania Council. In 1722, he was ordered not to publish anything without prior authorization. And in 1729, he was jailed for having published a wicked and seditious libel against the king and was only set free after disclosing the identity of the author. And this is where history once again plays tricks with us, blurring the neat narrative of staunch and principled American free speech defenders. On both occasions, one of the council members who sent Bradford to jail was none other than Andrew Hamilton, the hero of the Sanger case. But it gets worse. In 1757, Pennsylvania Judge William Moore was investigated by the Pennsylvania Assembly for abuse of office. The Assembly also wrote an open letter to the governor in a newspaper demanding Moore's removal from office. Moore replied, and his rebuttal was published in several newspapers, including a German-language one co-founded by the Reverend William Smith. Both Smith and Moore were unpopular with the Quaker majority, and when a newly elected assembly met in 1758, Smith and Moore were arrested for libeling the House, Constitution, and Government of Pennsylvania. Although Moore's criticism had been aimed at the preceding assembly, and none of the other publishers who had printed the article were targeted. Moore's publication was ordered burned, and he was sentenced to be held in jail indefinitely with no possibility of habeas corpus or posting bail. The assembly then declared Smith guilty of promoting and publishing Moore's libel a week before the trial was even about to start. at the trial, Smith was sentenced to jail until he apologized. The case took a number of further absurd twists that we don't have time to cover. But Smith fled to England and petitioned the Privy Council for relief. But his petition was opposed by the official agent of Pennsylvania's Assembly in London, Benjamin Franklin. Yes, good old Silas Doggett and the legendary printer who founded the Pennsylvania Gazette, where he in 1737 wrote,
"Freedom of speech is a principal pillar of a free government. When this support is taken away, the constitution of a free society is dissolved and tyranny is erected on its ruins."
But now, Franklin wrote a detailed rebuttal of Smith's complaint and vigorously defended legislative privilege in a case which Leonard Livy furiously described as comparable to Stuart despotism, involving a mock trial before a kangaroo court and worse than Star Chamber justice. Despite these shortcomings, Franklin insisted that the Assembly was the representative of the people, and without such a power of legislative assembly, no authority or decency can be preserved. And everyone knew that Smith was but a common scribbler of libels and false abusive papers, both against public bodies and private persons, thereby keeping up party heats in the province. And Smith only had to acknowledge and apologize for his offense to be set free. So what was the problem? It too, Franklin. But let's not end on such a low note. Because even with the continued enforcement of legislative privilege, it cannot be denied that American free speech had been expanded hugely in the 18th century and created a lively and much more pluralist public debate unimaginable in the quiet days of the 17th century. Leonard Levy might be correct that no one challenged seditious libel as such, but the scope and reach of seditious libel had been radically reduced. In fact, you might argue that the ideas of popular sovereignty and the need to protect the freedom of the people against oppressive governors served both to immunize colonists from being tried for seditious libel in courts and legitimize legislative privilege. For the Assembly saw themselves as the people's representatives and defenders against the executive. Undermining the Assembly's therefore undermined the people's liberties, the logic went. The idea that the bulwark of liberty also had to protect the people from their own representatives had not yet clearly crystallized among American colonists, influenced by Cato's letters, which chiefly warned against the executive and ministerial plots and not overzealous parliaments. But an early step in this direction was taken by John Fowle, who in 1754 had been imprisoned by the House of Representatives in Massachusetts for printing The Monster of Monsters, which included false scandalous libel and breached the House's privilege. Even though he was released after 6 days, Fowle protested his treatment in a pamphlet. He agreed that assemblies represented the people, but only
in a qualified sense, when they act according to the laws of the land, and their conduct is agreeable to the constitution of a free people, and consequently will be approved by the voice of the people.
Eventually, Fowle's dogged and incredibly stubborn pursuit of justice led the General Court of Massachusetts to pay him £50 in damages in 1667. A sign of things to come, but not until independence raised the question of how Americans free to regulate themselves should draw the line between collective and individual freedom. For soon, dramatic events would embroil the colonial press in a clash with the authorities in the mother country. And press freedom would become a rallying cry for patriots who used their freedom of speech to fan the flames of revolutionary dissent. More on that in part two. Thank you so much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, and Matthias Meyer contributed with research. If you like this episode, why not like and share it on social media, and most importantly, leave a review on iTunes.